Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter, editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report, and this is a special episode in your podcast feed. You're about to hear a recent edition of Editor's Roundtable, our Cook Political Report podcast, where our team of editors trades behind-the-scenes analysis and dives into the weeds on races and elections. If you're a political junkie, and chances are high that you are if you're listening to this, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to Editor's Roundtable today for just $1.99 a month. Okay, enjoy the show. Hey there, I'm Amy Walter. This is the Editor's Roundtable brought to you by the Cook Political Report. I am joined today by my colleagues Matthew Klein and Aaron Covey. Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Hey, Amy.
Today is a wonderful day because today is a house day, and there is nothing better than, to me, than getting to dive deep into all things U.S. House related. Now, we're talking about the House today for a couple of reasons. The first is, the very first House ratings of 2026 have been released. You can find all of those ratings on the competitiveness of the 435 races and write up on cookpolitical.com. What I also wanted to do today was talk about the House in both a big picture and then maybe a more granular level, which is why Matthew and Aaron are the perfect folks to join me to talk about this. The first is the big picture. We are still 21 months out from the next election, but history tells us that the party in the White House always loses seats in a midterm election, and with Republicans holding just a slim 3-seat margin, they look to be in serious danger based on history and the numbers of, again, just having 3-seat margin of losing their majority. But, and Erin talked about this in her piece, that this is also a very small playing field, a much smaller playing field than the one we saw just a few years ago in 2018 when Democrats did flip control of the House that year. And of course, we're still so far out that we don't know what the political environment is actually going to look like. At this point in 2021, things were looking very, very dire for Democrats. Just a few months later, the Dobbs decision came down on abortion and the 2022 midterm elections looked very different. But what I also want to do is get into some of these individual races, because this is the fun stuff, where there may be, I don't know, disagreements about where these races should start at this point in the cycle, where they may end up. So with that big, long opening, Aaron, let's just talk about this big picture thing. Like, how do you go into putting together these first ratings, and how do you go about thinking of where control of the House and where the competitiveness of these individual seats stand this far out from the actual midterm?
Yeah. So on one hand, when I'm thinking about ratings that are for races that are going to happen, I think like 600 days from now, roughly, it is very difficult because we have the least amount of data and information, and we don't have generally a sense of what the political environment is going to be aside from historic trends that we can look at, of course. But at the same time, it's also the lowest stakes point in the cycle because we know that things will change. And yes, right now, the battlefield that we're looking at looks fairly small. But I wouldn't be surprised if that changes. When we were at this point in 2017, the races that were on the ratings page were wildly different than what they ended up by the time we got to the actual midterm elections during Trump's first term. I was just looking back at that. And so with that in mind, we are still trying to put the knowledge that this should be a better environment for Democrats than we saw last November into the ratings decisions we're making. There are also, to your point, Amy, some structural differences between the cycle and 2018, which is the point that Republicans keep bringing up, which is true, that the Republicans who are in crossover territory from based on the previous election results are quite smaller than the number who were in difficult territory in 2018. Right. So at the start of the 2018 cycle, there were, or I believe at the when we came to the 2018 election, there were 25 Republicans who were in seats that Clinton had carried 2 years prior. And now going into the 2026 cycle, there's just three Republicans in right. seats that Harris won. And then you have 13 Democrats in Trump seats. So there is like that structural advantage that Republicans have this cycle that they maybe didn't have in 2018. But, you know, however, a big part of the reason why that is the case is because relative to how Trump did, House Republicans did underperform in a lot of key places. And so I think there's an open question of, yes, these are Trump seats in 2024, but are these actually seats that a down ballot Republican, a generic Republican, can also win?
Before we get into the individual races, although some of those individual races we were talking about are in this part of the country, but when you're talking about the difference between a midterm year and a presidential year, one place that has become just really fascinating is the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. And to see how quickly and dramatically that part of the country has shifted from supporting Democrats to supporting Republicans and specifically to supporting Trump makes that part, those seats down there, really fascinating.
It reminds me a little bit of the realignment in West Virginia that happened, you know, a decade or two ago.
Did you write your thesis on this, Matthew Klein?
Amy, the real ones know I did write my college thesis. I didn't want to brag about that.
Oh, I actually did not know that, so I guess I'm not a real one.
That's right. But it reminds me of that because, you know, the Democrats had basically been in power in West Virginia for like a solid 80 years, much like the Rio Grande Valley. It wasn't even a very contested state. And then, you know, a lot, it happened very quickly, first at the presidential level, started in around 2000 with George W. Bush, and then over the next two decades or so, ended up becoming a total realignment into the way that now the Republicans have basically complete control of West Virginia. And I just sort of wonder if we're going to end up inevitably looking at the Rio Grande Valley sort of in the way that we look at some of those old West Virginia Democrats, where we're thinking, gosh, how did Democrats ever even compete there? You know, we don't know. It's obviously very early, but there were a lot of people who hypothesized that West Virginia realignment might be a function of Barack Obama specifically, much in the same way we're hearing, you know, maybe this is about Donald Trump specifically. And I think what we're seeing down ballot is it's a slower trend, but it's happening nonetheless.
Yeah. Go ahead, Aaron.
No, and I mean, I think, yes, you can't separate Trump from the conversation, but it is also true that Republicans down ballot are making significant gains. And Republicans at the county level in Texas, they have county judges, which are basically county executives who are switching parties because they understand where the future of their county is headed. And, you know, like I think the most striking example is probably Texas's 34th district, which includes Cameron County, Brownsville. And this is a district that Clinton carried by, I believe, 36 points in 2016. Then it went to a seat that Biden carried by 16 points in 2020. And then this past year, Trump carried it by 4 points. So this is a seat that is just rocketing to the right. Yeah. Very, very quickly. And though it is still held by a Democrat, Vicente Gonzalez, we're starting that race out in toss-up just because of those trend lines.
Yeah, and I guess that's the question, you guys, which is much like in West Virginia, you had individual Democrats who could hold on despite those changes, obviously Joe Manchin being the primary example of this.
Joe Manchin, great example.
But once those sort of ancestral Democrats left office, there was nobody in the Democratic Party who could appeal in the same way. And Aaron, talk about that for a second, because it does seem like we're talking in some cases about, you know, the competitiveness of these districts being driven by the kind of candidate that Democrats have, either the incumbent who remains popular, And I'm thinking in particular of Henry Cuellar. This is somebody who's been in office now. How many years has he been in office?
20.
Yeah.
Okay. 20 years. He won last year, despite Trump winning his district and being under indictment.
He should get a prize for that. I mean, really. What? That's a twofer.
What happens now? He outperformed Trump by more than anybody?
More than any other House Democrat in a competitive district.
Again, under indictment.
More than Jared Golden. So
right.
That goes to show what sort of local appeal and just cult of personality he has around him. I mean, his nickname is the King of Laredo. So that kind of sums it up. But that was one where I think that would be an interesting case of a district that we all had varying opinions on. A lot of the sources we talked to had varying opinions on. So, Matthew, I want to get your thoughts on kind of why you think Cuellar is vulnerable. And kind of we can go into the debate we had over whether or not to start him off in a lean D, which would give him a clear advantage, or a toss-up race.
Well, as usual, Aaron wins out in most of our discussions. But I was sort of a believer that that there was a case for Cuellar starting in the toss-up column. And the main reason for that was because in looking at his 2024 performance, yes, he outran Kamala Harris by a huge amount, obviously, you know, performed remarkably well considering the circumstances at the top of the ticket. But he still only won his race by between 5 and 6 points, and he was facing a candidate that Republicans essentially put no money behind, had no money, let alone didn't get any outside help from anyone in Washington, and who also was white. And there, you know, this is a seat that's it's got to be at least over 80% Hispanic, and it seems like the right kind of Hispanic Republican candidate, of whom there are some, including Ryan Guillen, who is a well-known state representative from the area, from Rio Grande City, who just switched parties from a Democratic to Republican. If they land the right recruit, then I do think he is in real danger. But you're right. Right now, we don't know. We don't know what that who their recruit is going to be. And we do know that Henry Cuellar still remains very popular. Obviously, this is a district with an unusual number of question marks, both because of its trajectory and because of the fact that its incumbent is under indictment and seems to not really be facing a lot of penalties for that, at least at the moment.
Right. Theoretically, his trial is scheduled for September, but there is some question of whether that will get pushed back again. And whether he's able to maybe pull in Eric Adams.
Right. So TBD. On that, another one, you all, that I think there's some back and forth about where this race should start off in terms of our ratings. Long Island is another part of the country that has been, you know, it has shifted back and forth, at least in the time that I've covered politics. It was for years, very strongly Republican area where it's machine politics. There was a significant drop off of Republican support in the 2000s, especially in the mid-2000s, as the machine was sort of falling apart. And now we see that Republicans are on the ascendancy on Long Island. So talk a little bit about that, you guys, about how you see there are two Democratic-held seats on Long Island. One you all put into toss-up, which is the most competitive category, and one you put into lean Democrat.
Yeah, so I think these two districts are fairly similar in terms of the presidential results in these places. Last cycle, it's New York's 4th district and New York's 3rd district. The 4th is held by freshman Democrat Laura Gillen. The 3rd is held by Tom Suozzi, who previously had represented this seat, had left to run for governor. That didn't work out, but then came back and won a special election for the seat and flipped it back for Democrats. So
this is the old George Santos seat for those lay political viewers. This is, you know, that might jog your memory a bit.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So this is the special election to replace Santos. That's how Suozzi got back into Congress. So I think, yes, these are similar districts at the presidential level. The 4th is actually a little bit better for Democrats. It's one that Kamala Harris narrowly won last year, whereas Trump won the 3rd by a couple of points. But I do think this is kind of where maybe it's less about like the regional trends that I'm looking at and more just about the margins. I do think most of the races in our toss-up category were decided by less than 4 points. I believe all but maybe one was decided by less than 4 points. In fact, many of them by an even smaller margin. And so with Laura Gillen's race, she had an incredibly close race, won by, was it 2 points, Matthew?
Mm-hmm. 51-49.
Right. And so, and then you had Swazi, who won by close to 6 points, I believe, somewhere between 5 and 6.
It was a little closer than that. It was actually 51-8 to 48.2 in the end. So it was pretty close. And the reason that I also had a feeling maybe a little bit differently than Aaron on this one was just that was a very tight margin. And again, this was a candidate Republicans just didn't put that much effort behind. And Swazi was considered, after his special election victory, which he won by, I think, 8 or 9, he was sort of seen as untouchable. The Republicans kind of essentially were like, you know, we'll just give that guy a break. We have better options elsewhere on the map, which was true. But even without making much of an investment, the shifts on Long Island seemed to be carrying, and while Swazi's brand was helpful and undeniably a benefit to him, it does seem like these tectonic shifts on Long Island are not he's not immune from them.
That is true. And I do think that I could certainly see this race moving into the toss-up category, depending on who Republicans recruit and also what the environment looks like. Because I do think this is, you know, we have to account for the fact that we should expect this to be a slightly better environment, even on Long Island, while its trajectory may be going one direction. Without Trump on the ballot, is he going to draw out the same level of supporters who will be opposed to someone like a Swazi or a Gillen? I'm not quite sure about that, but, you know, we'll see. It's tough with these parts of the country that are kind of moving one direction rapidly. And when you have like maybe a midterm cycle that you would expect historically to help the other party, but one party is kind of on the ascendance, it's difficult to weigh those two factors against each other.
Right. Matthew, is there another district that you would look at and say, man, I'm really torn about whether this fits more in with one that is a little less competitive versus one that is much more competitive?
Well, we discussed and debated Alaska's at-large district for a while. This is a seat that, you know, it should be very solidly Republican. Alaska went to Donald Trump by 13 points. But Alaska is also very politically unique. It feels very far removed from Washington. They have sort of their own political landscape with bizarre coalitions that form in the legislatures, and partisan norms are sort of a little bit different there. Republicans flipped this seat very narrowly in 2024, in part because of Trump's strong performance at the top of the ticket. But Democrats had a great incumbent there, a very, very strong fit for Alaska, Mary Peltola. We just don't know if she's going to run again. It seems probably like she'll run for governor, but we don't know that for a fact. And there are probably some strong names in Alaska who could give the incumbent now, Nick Begich III, a Republican, a run for his money. But we don't know who they are. That's kind of a, you know, again, there aren't a ton of prominent Democrats who are, you know, great, well-known names in Alaska. There's not a very big Democratic bench. And again, it's a Trump 13 state. Now you have to defeat an incumbent Republican, a little bit on the tougher side. So I was in favor of starting that in likely R, but I know Aaron had we considered starting that in lean Republican. Do you have thoughts on that, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another weird situation where, like you said, the Alaska kind of has this strong independent streak and is so far removed from Washington that you can't just maybe look at the presidential results of the state and make an assumption about the partisanship as a result. The other factor is that they use ranked choice voting, despite the fact that it almost got repealed last November because it has typically tended to benefit the more moderate folks in the state over the more conservative Republicans. So folks like Lisa Murkowski, the senator, and Mary Peltola, the Democrat who held this seat for a couple of years, they really benefited from the fact that this model of voting tends to benefit folks who are seen as more moderate or centrist because they just get a broader base of support that way. And so because of that, that also kind of scrambles the way we would think about a race in Alaska. I do think that, you know, whether or not Peltola chooses to run for her seat again will have a huge impact, and it would be significantly less competitive if she doesn't run, and it seems like she is not likely to run. My other thought, though, is that it wasn't like she was particularly well known before she ran for Congress.
That's true.
And I think Alaska, to your point about the legislature, is the kind of state that can produce these more independent-leaning politicians who we may have no idea about here in D.C. So we'll see.
Yeah, don't they have a legislature that's like power-sharing?
In both chambers.
Situation?
Yeah.
Both chambers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that is really, really unique. Maybe you, Matthew, when you were talking about there are no big names in Alaska politics who are Democrats, there is one guy who used to be a senator named Mark Begich, who I think, is he the uncle, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yes, he's the uncle.
Yes, which would be kind of awkward, but interesting. I've not heard him at all, so I'm just making this up. I don't know that he's interested at all in this, but Begich v. Begich,
I would love that.
Would be quite interesting.
It would be,
right?
Now, it would,
that'd be kind of fun.
It would be a pain to write about. Because, we really only refer to people by their last names, so we would have to get very specific. It's giving shades of the Warner versus Warner Senate race in 1996 in Virginia.
Exactly.
Just going to ask you, Amy, I had a question for you, because I don't know how many of our Cook Political Report followers were around when you were covering the House yourself. That was not meant as a dig.
It kind of came across as the old person. But as the old person, yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask if this brought back any memories for what it was like for you during the 10 years that you did the House beat and how things might have changed in the time since.
It's such a good question, because I was just looking at this and thinking, when I first came to Washington, my first job in politics was 1994, which also happened to be the first time in 40 years that Democrats lost control of the House. So for the first time in 40 years, Republicans gained control of the House majority. And then it took another 12 years before it flipped. And that was the 2006 cycle, which was my last cycle covering the House. And then since then, it flips like every 10 minutes, right? So if you think about, you know, it took 52 years for the House to kind of go flip and then flip back. And now since then, you have 10, 18, 22, and potentially 26, right? So it's coming in a faster clip. And I think the reality of our politics now and what makes it so dynamic and why the House is always now up for grabs is the House is pretty well sorted, right? Like, there aren't many, as Aaron pointed out, there just aren't many incumbents sitting in districts that their party, their presidential candidate, did not carry in the last election. And so there are fewer and fewer targets. It's harder and harder to sneak up on folks when you have more money, I think, now than ever, and more outside groups than ever dedicated to playing in House politics. The amount of money now that it takes. I mean, Matthew, the thought of, I think, what was the most expensive race last cycle in the House?
Oh, great question. Probably Alaska.
I think it was California 45.
Oh, that's possible. That's the LA
or New York, or New York 19. It was one of
those.
Yeah,
maybe one of the New York.
Yeah.
Okay, which was what? Like, what's the category of amount of money that would be?
Oh, gosh.
And like millions upon millions.
Yeah, tens of millions.
Yeah.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Right. For one race, which is crazy.
Right, for one race. The idea in 2006 that amount of money would be spent in one House district was absurd. Nobody would have possibly thought that. And so, you know, you have more and more money now in the pipeline going to fewer and fewer districts. Mm. And that means now that, you know, in every single election, these House races become sort of mini presidential contests, and they take on this outsized import in a way that you just didn't see in the earlier eras. But what is the same is that I think people still don't appreciate how unique the House still is. And this is what I really enjoy about it. And I think we can all point to examples from the last cycle even of individual members of Congress who by the numbers probably shouldn't have won, but because either the campaign they ran, the strength of their candidacy, the weakness of their opponent's candidacy, they were able to hold on. And so campaigns do still matter. And maybe that's where we end it here, you guys. If you look at a race, it can be from last cycle, it can be from a previous cycle, but where someone was able to win, even though the numbers and the data and the modeling would have told you otherwise, what would you pick?
Well, I think I have to say Don Bacon.
Oh, man, Don Bacon.
He was the only race that was a miss for us last cycle, if you're defining a miss, as we had it rated in a category that it went against. So we ended up moving it to lean Democrat shortly before the election, and he ended up winning re-election. And this is the bluest seat held by a Republican member of Congress. It's not that blue. Harris won it by 5 points, so this is not like an insanely huge overperformance, but it's an impressive one nonetheless, and it's impressive the winning streak that he has been on since he was first elected since 2016. So we're starting him in toss-up because, again, that's like in a midterm cycle. He has won by a big enough margin each time that would maybe, if this was like a more neutral environment we were expecting, give him the benefit of the advantage. But I do think in a midterm cycle and the bluest seat held by a Republican in the country, you got to start it in toss-up. So that's what I would point out.
Yeah, that's a good one. Matthew?
I'll pick the anti-Don Bacon, the Wario of Don Bacon, if you will. the Democratic version, which is Jared Golden, who Republicans have been desperately trying to unseat for, I guess, 1, 2, 3, 4 cycles now, and wins, you know, last cycle, won again by this extremely narrow margin. Northern Maine, another very politically independent part of the country. Jared Golden, of course, has a great, you know, he's crafted a great brand, always lots of ads with lobster fishing and all sorts of Maine
tattoos
and Maine related
tattoos and lobster. That is Maine too, right there.
That's the second district right there. So he would be my pick. We'll see if he runs for governor what that race to replace him looks like. Could be a good opportunity for the GOP.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a lot of fun. I cannot wait. Do we get deeper in this? But I think this is a great place to start. And we obviously will have a lot of updates for all of you, our listeners, as we go through this cycle. Just want to make one more pitch that if you are not a subscriber to the Cook Political Report, you should consider subscribing today. Just think of all of the stuff we talked about is all right in front of you. You can click on it at any time. Each one of these House races we've talked about has an actual race page attached to it. You can see what the district looks like, past performance of those candidates, presidential performance, the analysis of the race, the candidate names. It's all right there, right in front of you. Very affordable, very cool. You can get to it, of course, by going to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Next week, we have our first Senate ratings, which also will give us a lot of fodder to get into for Editors Roundtable. Until then, we say thank you. And Matthew, thank you for all your questions. Thanks for looking out for this old lady.
You know what? You can leave the house all you want, but the house never leaves you.
That's it. We can just leave it there. Bye, guys.